Welcome, everybody, to pod number 67 of the Metabilis podcast, which features myself, Ben.
And David.
And David, I think we have some listener feedback.
Yes, our listener did tweet in with his list. Stephen B., who has the Twitter handle of @steedstyling,
came up with a list. I love him.
And he is of the New to Who podcast. His list is, he starts with Unearthly Child, but he specifies only episode one.
Oh, okay.
Moves on to The Invasion, Spearhead from Space, Genesis of the Daleks, City of Death, Caves of Androzani, Vengeance on Varos, Remembrance of the Daleks, the TV movie, Dalek, Army of Ghosts and Doomsday, The 11th Hour, World Enough in Time, and The Doctor Falls.
Blimey. Well, that's just a list of really, really good episodes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Very Dalek intense.
Very Dalek intense. Quite heavy on the let's introduce a new doctor.
Yep.
But that's not a bad thing. It's always fun to have a new doctor introduced. So that's, I mean, that would be a very, very high level 13 faces of Doctor Who, I think.
Yep. And so thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
So what is our topic for this podcast?
Let me just give our listener a clue, and I will give the clue by going, Sontaha! did I do that right? I don't know.
I don't know.
Sontarans is what we're talking about.
So shall we go in this is going to be a hard night. I am very tired.
We are both at a low ebb, listener. We're both at a low ebb. So only the exciting prospect of Sontarans can stir us from our slumbers.
Yeah, so normally we record on a Sunday afternoon. This is rather laid back, but tonight,
working on a Sunday.
No weekend, and then working today, we are recording Monday night. So it is not the ideal recording circumstances. But the question I had is, should we go chronologically in order then and start off with this? Season 11 with Bob Holmes's debut script of the Sontarans, the Time Warrior.
Yeah, I'm just going to slip out of my clone vat and just go straight in. Yeah, well, let's go with the opening. Let's go straight with the Sontarans. And as far as I remember, and David, you can correct me if I'm wrong, as for what I've read, that Sontarans originally were kind of a monster of the week joke, right? The idea being, what would it be like if there was a Doctor Who monster whom, when they took their helmets off, their heads were exactly the same shape as their helmets.
And that kind of Mr. Potato Head type
shape. Yeah, yeah. Because I think what's interesting about the Time Warrior is actually the time traveling aspect of it, because the Doctor doesn't really encounter time traveling aliens that much, or at least didn't encounter.
It's pretty much the Daleks and now the Sontarans.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, there's our delightful time monster, which is, you know, really a kind of
a chronivore, right?
A kind of a creature of time rather than a time traveling creature. A creature of time rather than a time traveling creature. I like that. But the Sontarans, they're pretty unique. I mean, they're kind of nasty, brutish, and short, obviously, as Thomas Hobbes no doubt would have described them had they been around during the English Civil War. But they're also pretty efficient time travelers. I mean, they can time travel without a TARDIS, and they can grab things. They can locate things outside of the time that they happen to be in,
right,
and move them to where they are, which seems is like really. I mean, that seems to be the most useful kind of time travel. To me.
Yeah, because Lynx is our Sontaran in The Time Warrior, and his ship is stranded. It crashes in the middle of the night in medieval Europe, and he uses his time technology to pluck scientists out from the 20th century, people and materiel to rebuild and repair his spacecraft.
Yeah. You wonder why he didn't just pluck scientists from, like, instead of the 1970s, I don't know, the 2370s.
Well, he explains that.
Oh, does he? Sorry, everybody.
That was the furthest out he could go.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Okay, and this is my other question about a story that I have obviously not rewatched in preparation for this podcast. Is he from the Middle Ages, i.e., does the Sontaran, propulsion technology, or however they use to move their little globes around, when it breaks, does it drop him back through time? Or basically what interests me is that, we have this idea of this kind of Rutan-Sontaran war, which, if it takes place in real time, stretches from, the Middle Ages, the time of Richard I, or so, all the way until after the solar flares have devastated the planet Earth and the kind of Nerva beacon time, which is a very long period to have a war in.
Well, Lynx is saying that the Sontarans have been at war for a millennia at that point. So that's a good question. I don't know if he fell back in time or if the war is just going on
for literally thousands and thousands of
years. Yeah. My interpretation was that Lynx was contemporary with the Middle Ages in Earth history, and that's why Earth had no strategic value at all. It was just a backwater.
Which is ironic, because, of course, when we get to Field Commander Steyr a little bit later on, the Earth has assumed quite significant strategic importance, which I guess that's what happens in wars. I mean, things go forwards, things go backwards. But, I mean, I think it is instructive that, of course, certainly according to a human scale, this war has been going on for a very, 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 very long time.
But at least the Sontarans are a time-traveling race, and so it could be a very short war fought across a very large, time-wise, battlefield.
That is true, and we get into time war territory here. I mean, I guess I haven't, because, there are only a certain number of hours in my day, I've not really engaged with any Big Finish's time war recent Time War audio. So do we know whether they involve the Sontarans at all as a time-traveling race, or is it really just the Daleks that we're kind of obsessing about at this point?
I think they were denied access to the war.
Oh, really?
Time War or something
the
like
time
that.
War.
But they do appear in one of the War Doctor stories in a central role, so it's a mixed bag.
Okay, some of my questions have been asked.
Right.
I feel that actually in some ways the Sontarans were never better than when there was one of them and it was in the Time Warrior. It's a particularly compelling performance. He's really good. Who is he?
It is...
He's some Australian dude, right?
It's Kevin Lindsay.
Kevin Lindsay, that's it. And he does it very well, and, it's particularly disgusting. His little pink tongue... which flickers about horribly, I think is great.
And that was Kevin Lindsay's innovation. That was not scripted. That was how he decided with this very heavy rubber prosthetic mask how to make it a little more...
Actory.
To bring something to the role.
Yeah. And of course, if you read the actually really kind of excellent novelization, which I think is Dix, right? But it's Dix doing a really good job. Not that he doesn't usually do a good job, but some of the later novelizations, can be a little bit kind of by the numbers. Again, he really kind of piles on the kind of disgustingness of Sontarans and, the way that, there's kind of their horrible breath and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a really compelling performance. It's both humorous. I mean, I don't think that, in terms of kind of black humor, when Lynx emerges from his, really kind of pathetic looking spacecraft, and then erects the Sontaran flag, or what one must only assume is the Sontaran flag, and then kind of salutes it as conquering the Earth. It's a brilliant piece of, almost Douglas Adams-style black humor. And it does go from between, the description of Sarah Jane, the differently shaped thorax thing. There's a lot of comedy in this, but also a lot of darkness. I mean, the scientists are basically being tortured to death. Very much as our next Sontaran will behave in kind of labouring to make this spacecraft. They've never been better than when Kevin Lindsay was playing them, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Big fan of the Time Warrior,
and the Time Warrior really sets things up for the entire run of the Sontarans in the classic series, because we introduce time travel, which we'll see echoed in with the invasion of time, the probic vent that's always their vulnerability. We see that being used throughout every Santaran story, and just the whole clone race, the warrior always fighting a war. It's interesting, and this is with Bob Holmes always building, with a line or two, building the Doctor Who universe. This is the first story that we find what the Doctor's home planet is called, Gallifrey.
Of course, and yes.
Of course a time-traveling race would be aware of another time-traveling race, and Lynx is very... looks down a short, stubby nose at the Gallifreyans because they aren't using their time travel to wage war, effectively.
Yeah, and you wonder, I mean, again, this is more kind of questioning. I mean, obviously, you know, latter day fanish explorations of Gallifrey in general have kind of really expanded on, you know, the importance of the Time Lords and their discovery mm-hmm. of time travel and citadels and black holes and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It is kind of interesting that actually you don't have to be all kind of highfalutin and all powerful, apparently, to have time travel.
Right.
You can be kind of down and dirty potato man. and you can still have time travel. I'd love to see I'd be very interested to see some kind of, you know, story that examines how the hell the Santarans got their hands on time travel technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, one might assume, actually, I mean, maybe they nicked some of it when they invaded Gallifrey in the Invasion of Time.
And that's then quite possible.
Used it to then do timey things.
Mm-hmm. Just because we have a chronological sequence in the series doesn't mean that those stories happen chronologically.
No. So it's entirely possible, but maybe they slipped, some kind of, you know, a dematerialization circuit or two in their pockets before they left or got killed. I can't actually remember how that one ends now. It just kind of finishes, doesn't it?
It's
before
the
they get dematted
at the
end of Invasion of Time. Who knows?
Now, with the story, did you see this on the original broadcast series 11?
Was I that did, been... yeah. Oh, yeah.
So can you think back? What was your impression of that?
Okay, so two main impressions, one of which very, very upset that Joe had gone.
Right.
But absolutely delighted with Sarah Jane. So it's like, wow, we've lost mm-hmm. one awesome assistant. And this assistant is even more awesomer. So I don't know how they managed to do it. Because obviously, you know, at the age, however old I was, how old was I? When was it broadcast? 74. You know, I was 7 or something. Mm-hmm. Quite a conservative child, as all children are. Didn't like change. But I do not remember resenting Sarah Jane at all. In terms of
the Santarans,
I was revolted by the Santarans. I found them really, really scary.
Right.
I loved the concept of the probic vent. I think for at least a couple of weeks, we played Santarans in the school playground. And the probic vent was like an absolute, it was a key part of the game, because if you were mm-hmm. able to bash someone on their probic vent, then they were dead, you know. So it was a perfect game to play, basically, because it meant...
Everyone chopping at everyone's back of their neck.
Exactly. But it means you had to sneak round behind someone
right.
to hit them, rather than as you usually would do, which is like hit the front of them.
And did you use the Pertwee high?
We didn't use the Pertwee high. No, we didn't. So, yeah, I remember deeply, deeply enjoying this episode, this story, mm-hmm. very, very much. Yeah.
Now, did it seem like a monster at the time that would, if we think of Doctor Who classic monsters, they're right in there of perhaps the top three reoccurring monsters. We, you know, Daleks are obviously at the top of the heap. Then we have Cybermen.
Yeah.
Then, you know, Santarans, perhaps?
I think it was too early in my Who watching life to realize that there were monsters that would come back, because I don't think there were any returning monsters. As regular listeners of the podcast will know, my very first Doctor Who was the Christmas repeat of the Sea Devils, mm-hmm. and then the first actual Who was the Three Doctors. So there wasn't really a lot of repeating of monsters.
Right.
Going on. So, yeah, I think I was too young to really understand that things wouldn't come back or that they could mm-hmm. come back. It was just like every week, such a, you know, my mind was so incredibly blown every week by just a succession of monsters.
Right.
I think if you'd asked me, I would have gone, I don't know, just bring on more mm-hmm. stuff. How about you? When did you first see this?
I saw this must have been after the run of Tom Baker for at least two iterations of the entire Tom Baker run and Peter Davison's run, I think KTCA and Minneapolis-St. Paul broadcast Pertwee. And so this would have been obviously towards the end of Pertwee. So I had seen a lot of Doctor Who at this time. And every time I watch The Time Warrior, it seems a little dated to me. And it's hard for me for the suspension of disbelief because the medieval period just isn't quite right in my mind.
It's a bit Robot of Sherwood, certainly.
The castle interior is definitely screams soundstage. Mm. The wigs are a little too wiggy on...
There's the famous potato peeling scene.
Yeah.
But of course, there weren't any potatoes in medieval Europe, so should have used a turnip or rutabaga, as you would call them.
It never really made a big impact on me. Now, the following story, the Santarin experiment, I had seen at least twice before
the Time Warrior.
So that to me,
interesting.
That to me is what a Santarin looked like. So it's a little more rounder, a little more pale than the very brown,
kind of greasy looking.
Yeah, it looked very leathery Santarin in that Lynx was. So Steyr was more Humpty Dumpty, for lack of a better description of him. And the sadism of the Santarins really came through in the Santarin experiment. And I like watching the Santarin experiment, and it's not so much because of the topic or the Santarins. It's the field recording. The entire program is set on, was it Wensley Moor or not? That's the Silurians.
Dartmoor.
Dartmoor. So set on Dartmoor. That I really like the chemistry between the Doctor, Harry, Sarah. I like the South African accents on the Galsec
colonists.
So I really think it's very atmospheric, and I find that part very enjoyable. I thought the robot that they had in the Santarin experiment didn't seem like Santarin technology. It seemed incongruous with Santarins, but I don't know. Maybe it worked for you because you saw this exactly about a year after seeing The Time Warrior.
Yeah. And actually, this is just a quick sidebar. Have you seen the special edition DVD version of The Time Warrior where they exchange? They do
with the explosion kind of, at the end.
Yeah, they fix some of the screw ups that the classically bad two director Alan Bromley put in, which I think helps a little bit. Actually, I mean, it's a special edition that. I mean, I'll tend to watch the special edition rather than the regular one. I think it seemed to me at the time, or maybe this is just me being retrospective, but I think it seemed to me that the robot was there in order to disguise that there were Santarins, if you see what I mean.
I think so, yeah.
Which is weird, because, of course, it's called the Santarin Experiment, so you kind of expect them to turn up at some point.
Right.
But anyway, Santarin Experiment's brilliant. It's, it's short, it's punchy, it's really horribly sadistic, because by then we'd become incredibly attached to Sarah Jane, attached to Harry as well, and to have them be literally tortured in a way that was not physical but kind of mentally tortured.
Because Sarah is all mental. Field Major Steyr put this thing on her head that made her visualize all these horrors that we as the viewer get to see, but what Sarah is seeing, but it's all mental anguish.
Yeah, and then you get the idea that actually, and maybe this comes out more strongly in the novelization, which I can definitely recommend, written by Ian Marta, who of course plays Harry Sullivan, and his target novelizations really pile on the kind of horror. But you get the idea, and I think it comes out very strongly in novelization, but I think it also comes out strongly actually in the televised story, that Field Major Steyr is kind of doing this for fun. that there is, obviously there is this ostensive purpose that we've got to find out what humans are like so that we can work out how to defeat them, because this is an important planet. But there are kind of various clues or just kind of asides throughout the entire story where you basically realize he's just doing it because he's really enjoying it. He doesn't really have to do this that much. And, the fact that the whole thing kind of screeches to a halt when the Doctor kind of, you know, reveals to the other Sontaran that this is what humans are like. They're like me and I'm awesome, right. So you can't invade. It is actually kind of a nightmare situation. It also, just to go back to the whole playground thing, it also is part of this particular genius, I think, of 1970s Doctor Who, which of course I'm hopelessly biased towards, but I think it is a genius, whereby the Doctor's adventures take place in the same kind of environments that children play in. So in terms of kind of reproducing this story as a piece of play with your friends, you can do it. And it's this kind of really interesting kind of interplay between, you know, the Doctor and his companions are having an adventure in a place where you can also basically have the same adventure. And it really creates that kind of connection between the child and the actor, or the child and the story, which I think a lot of contemporary children's drama doesn't really think to do anymore. So I loved it.
It's very approachable, just not that you want kids reenacting torture scenes, but the idea of
hiding behind a rock because a robot's trying to get you.
Or the gravity bar.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all done through the acting. It's not really that heavy, but you pretend. And you can see that kind of pretend on the playground or with your friends in the neighborhood.
Yeah. My sister and I were lucky enough to have access to exactly the same kind of landscape within which the Sontaran experiment takes place. And we would play endlessly. I was the Doctor, she was Sarah. And we were being chased by a robot. Mm-hmm. And we did that for hours. It's, you know, it seems extraordinary now. At least it felt like hours. It was probably only 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, anyway. So back to the Sontarans, away from my childhood memories. I loved this one. I loved it then and I love it now. I think it's a great story. Kevin Lindsay, I remember thinking that he wasn't as good as a Sontaran than the original Sontaran. You have the other experience, which just mm-hmm. means that this whole thing is completely subjective.
Now, when you're playing with your sister, did you do things like your thorax is of a different construction, or go up to her, ooh, the female of the species, or anything?
No, I'm sadly...
kind of the classic tropes of the Sontarans?
No, we were too young for that kind of thing, I think, really. We were just the Doctor and Sarah, and, you know, and and the Doctor and Sarah were always having scary adventures together.
A lot of imagination,
huge amount of imagination. Basically, you know, we were being chased by a robot and we had to hide because the robot would get us, and, you know, eventually we'd get bored and just stop doing that. But yeah,
the robot was gone.
Yeah, the robot went away. We're fine now, it's time for our tea. So yeah,
now I think the Time Warrior plot makes a lot of sense in the Doctor Who confines of it. It introduces the Rutans. We have the Rutan reoccurrence here. That's why Earth now has strategic value in their war against the Rutans. Do you think the story actually makes any sense that Steyr baits a Galsec ship to land on this derelict Earth, obliterates the spaceship, and then with the final survivors, experiments on them, all the while having made a deal or controlling their leader through some kind of neck implant. And then once the game is up, once the Doctor upsets Steyr's plans and defeats them, do you think it's even makes sense for the Sontarans to call off the invasion without Steyr's really kind of pointless and needless research?
Well, it depends on how you interpret it, really. I mean, my own personal interpretation of this story is that Steyr is a really nasty piece of work who happens to have got himself a really sweet gig, which involves just torturing people as much as he likes. And in some ways, it's actually not that important, which is why the Sontarans call off the invasion. Because it's like, well, you know, we weren't actually that serious. You know, Steyr's kind of a dick, and he likes torturing people. He's tortured them all to death or something, and now he's died, and then this other bloke turns up, so maybe not. I mean, it kind of fits within my own, you know, narrative about the story, which is it's actually more about the torturing than any kind of actual military need, which I think sort of makes the Sontarans, to me, kind of makes them kind of more interesting, because they're not actually this kind of super efficient military race that they think they are. They're actually a kind of a race of idiots, which is, you know, is kind of exemplified by the by the very kind of stiff and stuck up way that Lynx behaves, you know, saluting the Sartorian flag, and the kind of, you know, ridiculous way that Steyr behaves, which is basically doing all this torturing for his own enjoyment.
They're very by the book.
They're very by the book, and I mean, it's some, you know, in some ways, you know, it's like so many, you know, British TV things from the 60s and 70s, you know, it's sort of like what we think about the Germans. You know, they're kind of stuck up, yet they're also a bunch of sadists. And you know what? They're no good at winning wars anyway, because we beat them twice. Ha ha ha. Yeah. You know, which is, you know, typical kind of British 1970s feeling towards the Germans.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that the Sartorians are a German proxy, because we definitely have the German proxy or the Nazi proxy with the Daleks.
I mean, I think, you know, if you look at kind of British culture in the 60s and 70s, I think any villain that you fight in any kind of drama is a proxy for either Germans or Nazis, probably both. I mean, actually, in some ways, I'm kind of warming to my theme here with relatively little evidence. The Daleks are proxies for the Nazis. The Sartorians are proxies for the Germans.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So moving swiftly, are we done with it?
It's a two-parter.
It's a two-parter.
So would you consider Horror of Fang Rock to be a Sartorian story? Because they're name-checked.
They are name-checked.
Only reason why we have the Rutans are because they are the foe of the Sartorians.
Yeah.
They are the yin to the Sartorian game.
Do we also assume that the Rutans have time travel technology?
I don't know if we know that.
I assume they must do. Otherwise the Sartorians would have...
They'd be at a distinct disadvantage.
Would have kicked their gelatinous butts.
So in the greater expanded Doctor Who universe, we do have the game that came out, I think, what, in 2011, I'm thinking? The Gunpowder Plot?
Yeah.
And that would examine the Rutans and the Sartorians' war one-on-one, and the Rutans were kind of at a disadvantage in that.
So maybe they don't.
Yeah, but that took help me out in the year. What year Gunpowder Plot?
1603, I think.
Okay, so that is when that story took place. So yes, we're in this perpetual war that neither side can win, but it definitely...
1605.
Okay, 1605. That definitely was took place non-contemporarily with Rory and Amy time, for example.
Yeah, and I think you know, having giving it some thought now as we talk about it, I mean, I think it is quite clear that, you know, that actually the Sartorian, the progress of this war does not take place in kind of linear time. If they're also kicking off with a war in Edwardian times and the time of James the First, the time of Richard the First, the time of the great, you know, after the great solar flares, I mean, they must be just whizzing around in time country, you know, which implies that the Rutans also have time travel technology as well.
Right. We've touched upon this, I think, in our previous conversations, but the whole idea of the Rutans, of this blobby jellyfish being against the potato monster, this contrasting forms of aliens being the joke or the comeback of Terrence Dix for his friend Bob Holmes, who he assigned the historical story, which Holmes wasn't really that interested in doing in the first place.
Right. Yeah, and it's a great interplay of two great writers who, you know, obviously had huge respect for each other and, you know, were kind of playing at this point, you know, which is makes for great writing.
Right.
You know, they were having fun, which I think is a great way to come up with things that work really well. If you're enjoying your job, then, you know, you do a good job.
Mm-hmm. And probably two individuals that weren't enjoying their job in season 15 was Anthony Reed and Graham Williams.
And who literally were not enjoying their jobs at that point, yeah.
Who came up under the pen name of David Agnew, The Invasion of Time. And we had just talked about that a few weeks ago.
Quite recently. And I think we cover the Sartorians then. And I think, you know, the main takeaway from the invasion of time is that it's a horrible, horrible story. just one of the worst. Mm-hmm. Yet it has one of the most effective and exciting, certainly when I very first watched it as a kid, the most effective and exciting cliffhangers ever in Doctor Who, which is the arrival of the Sontarans at mm-hmm. the end of episode 4.
Right.
Which I can actually remember being just completely just kind of knocked sideways by. And I think I still am. It's a great reveal. The right. music is awesome. The way they're shot is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It makes it worth watching, actually, which is something to be said for something that's basically pants all the way through.
Now, I think we didn't touch on whether the Sontarans were controlling the Vardens, were they allies of the Vardens, or is seizing upon the weakness of the Vardens, or seizing on the Vardens exploiting or attacking Gallifrey as a weakness in Gallifrey to exploit and conquer Gallifrey at that time. Do we know, or do you have a theory on what's the relationship between Sontarans and Vardens?
Well, I don't think we know, and in some ways I don't think we care. Certainly the story, as far as I remember, having just watched it, doesn't really tell us
right.
what relationship at all there is between mm-hmm. the Vardens and the Sontarans. I've always basically assumed that it's kind of a bit like those robot Santas and the Sycorax, you know, the Vardens are the kind of crap vanguard for the actual invasion. How that connects with the Doctor helping
the Vardens...
And then also then by mistake letting someone a lot more dangerous in. Again, the writers don't really think that we should understand how that happens. Mm-hmm. So we're not really told.
It seems to me more of a crime of opportunity or a war of opportunity. Gallifrey has its defenses totally down.
The Sontarans are passing, right.
They're a time-traveling race. They know opportunity now is to strike.
Yeah. That sounds most likely to me. I mean, the most confusing thing about Invasion of Time is, you know, why the hell the Doctor thinks the Vardens is such a great, mm-hmm. such a huge threat that he endangers, you know, the entire fabric of time.
It's tinfoil, because I think tinfoil really scares Gallifreyans.
Yeah, that wobbly, wobbly tinfoil. Or maybe it's just the very unconvincing acting that the Vardens do. Maybe that frightens people. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Yeah.
As we were discussing in the previous podcast, yeah. You know, if you don't have any money, maybe you can only afford to hire bad actors. Who knows?
I think with the invasion of time, too, a little less, but the Sontaran experiment. We have the costume on the rack. We've already established them. We only need a 2-episode story, but definitely by the time Invasion of Time ticks around, they are Monster of the Week. The production team has the costumes in store. They don't have to work on a backstory. Anthony Reed really felt like he could just drop them in. Oh, it's the Sontarans, and he didn't have to explain anything, and they can just pad out the rest of season 15 with 2 more episodes of Sontarans walking around a disused mental hospital.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been the Zygons. I guess they could have used the Rutans. I mean, they could have used any monster. And I guess in some ways, you know, it's probably easier to use something that Bob Holmes kind of owned or, you know, was involved with, because
right.
he, you know, was still, I guess, still kicking around the BBC at that point. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they're used very well. I mean, they're super effective. I think we had this discussion about Derek Deadman as Storr, you know, who, again, is very divisive in fandom, because, you know, he has this you know, very strong Cockney accent, which I always think is great, because, mm-hmm. you know, why shouldn't aliens have accents? Mm-hmm. You know, they have lots of other kind of accents. Of course, and again, as we had this discussion, it may be harder for American ears to kind of hear the kind of incongruousness of the kind of gore blimey governor. It's the Sontarans, and no mistake. But I think they acquit themselves very well. You know, they do get devoured and quite easily by plants. They're obviously challenged by a poolside furniture. You can imagine the Rutans just scattering some folding chairs, some deck chairs around. Ah, the Sontarans are defeated. So,
huzzah!
Hooray! Deck chairs win again. And actually, you know, actually having deck chairs as the Sontarans' enemy, you know, rather than the Vardens, well, they weren't their enemy, but, you know, I think deck chairs would be more effective, actually. A race of sentient deck chairs.
So, do you...
Deck chairs are kind of creepy. I mean, they're hard to erect. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think JNT really was using deck chairs a lot in his tenure. So, like, we see the opening of the Leisure Hive with a doctor sitting in a deck chair.
That's true.
Later, the first season of Peter Davison, the doctor is sitting, I think, in a deck chair after he's bowling cricket or in between.
I think he is. He's keen on deck chairs.
So I think there is a JNT deck chair agenda.
There is a secret deck chair agenda. Well, if we're talking about JNT, how about we move swiftly on to another absolute stone cold classic of Doctor Who, which is The Two Doctors.
Hmm. Yeah, so do you think the two, what do we got, Stike and Varl in The Two Doctors are two Santarns, name check Santarns in there? Do you think they're a more effective Santaran duel than we have with the Santarans in The Invasion of Time? Or,
well,
I mean, the knock against the Santarans here is they're a clone race, but they're of two different heights and they're very tall.
They're also, they're not just very tall, they're freakishly tall. It's not just like kind of accidentally tall. It's like we deliberately hired two actors who were way taller than they should have been. Mm-hmm. To play these characters. In the spirit of full disclosure, at this point in the history of Doctor Who, I kind of wasn't watching Doctor Who because it sucked. So I definitely didn't watch The Two Doctors. I think I watched the first episode of The Two Doctors because I was curious about Pat Troughton.
Right.
I didn't like his grey hair, mm-hmm. and I immediately then turned off, basically, and I right. didn't watch the rest of it. I have watched it, I think, once or maybe twice on DVD, mm-hmm. but mainly to look at the Jimmy Savile bit, mm. Which of course you can't really get anymore because Jimmy Savile was revealed as being a
which
monster,
a real...
far greater than the Santarans, ironically.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation that Colin Baker made in the VAM, Value Added Material, in the Santaran Experiment. They were talking about Jim Will Fix It and a brief little episode. In A Fix with the Santarans that Colin Baker recorded. And they leave him with the observation that Colin Baker says, I'll paraphrase, I can't quote him verbatim, but
right.
Savile was a much greater monster in many ways than the Santarans. And this was way before the news was made public that he was... you know, a predator.
Well, I mean, to completely sidebar about Jimmy Savile, what was weird about him is that everybody knew what he was like, but no one did anything about it, which was incredibly weird, actually, when you look back at, you know, exactly how pervasive he was in terms of British culture, and just what a terrible, terrible, terrible person he was in every way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that he pretty much admitted it when those interviews with Louis Theroux. If you want to kind of understand, you know, the psychologies of fame and national characters and things like that, I think you do well to read up about Jimmy Savile. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's enough about Jimmy Savile. The Two Doctors is not very good. And so I didn't watch it at the time. And I'm even older now and I still really can't get into it. Mm-hmm. It really does seem that there's two people who are dressed up as Santarans who are pretending to be Santarans.
Fancy dress Santarans.
You know, their heads don't connect to the top of their costumes right.
Right.
You can see everything moving around. It's like it's Halloween and they've gone as Santarans.
Well, the problem...
they've got their Santaran costume from Party City.
the problem is they're filming in Seville, Spain, and it's really, really hot. And you have...
What a surprise!
These monster masks that are, you know, latex rubber.
Made of latex.
You're in... these padded suits, the actors who are playing the Santarans are probably losing 10 pounds of body water a day. You know, it's really hard to make rubber monster masks look good in that kind of heat with that kind of recording pressure that they have.
Let's sidebar a little bit here again. You know, I mean, you know, one can talk about what an amazing producer JNT was. He wasn't that good, you know.
He was good with the numbers. He was good with the showmanship of it. But for He wasn't a storyteller. He wasn't
filming in Seville, right, in the middle of the summer, with, you know, latex costumes. That's not going to come up. You're not going to come up with a good result,
right? But you do. But you do get.
You should realize that as a producer. Mm-hmm.
But you do realize, as a producer of JNT's caliber, that you do get a paid by BBC vacation to Spain, which is the whole reason it was set there.
Yep. You get a free trip to Spain with all your mates. Mm-hmm. And, you know, apart from the horrible bit, which is like filming this dreadful story, mm-hmm, you get to lark around in the swimming pool and you get to stay in a hotel. And right, it's, you know, I don't know. What's your take on the two? When did you first see the two doctors?
I saw the two doctors probably 6 months after it was broadcast in the UK. In the US, since the public television contract had pretty good turnaround.
Right.
Every time I've watched this, I've liked it less and less. I really, I really do not like the Andragum cannibalism or.
No, it's not funny, and it's good either. It's none of those, mm-hmm, things.
So I don't find really anything that redeeming for it. I like seeing Patrick Troughton. I hate seeing him being turned into an Andragum. So that, mm-hmm, there's just not really much there to like. I like the portrayal that James Saxon had of Oscar, but
right,
I felt he was killed needlessly. There wasn't really any story reason for him. Just it's just a gratuitous 1980s Eric Sayward style death,
violence. Yeah.
And I didn't really have any problem with the Santarans because they're like croutons on the salad. You can ignore them. You can flick them off. They really aren't that central to the story. It seems to be more a story, yeah, of Destari, and the question is, can you civilize through surgery or genetic modification a savage or a barbaric alien race? And the Santarans just seem like extra. They seem like the same level of detail that we had in The Invasion of Time. It probably would have been a better story without them. And probably a better story without Troughton and Fraser Hines.
And I think in some ways, you know, I think my impression is that certainly the Santarans and possibly even Patrick Troughton and Fraser Hines were kind of imposed on the story really by the production team.
Right.
You know, because they're not that necessary. And I think if you were to strip away the Santarans, the story actually becomes more interesting because there's less of it. And so it has more time to breathe and you possibly have more time to kind of understand and talk about what the hell's going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wouldn't be a super interesting story, but I think it would be a better story, mm-hmm, without, you know, a literal kind of monster of the week. Mm-hmm. Who could we have? Well, I guess he's written for the Santarans, so he must know how to write for them. Mm-hmm. So let's just put those in and all the fans will be happy, mm-hmm, because here are the Santarans back. And I think this is one of the kind of key points of the what's wrong with the JNT era, is that it has this weird idea that all you have to do is include an old monster,
right,
and the fans will be happy. Well, you know what makes the fans happy? A, is good stories. But if they're not good stories, include the monster properly. Mm-hmm. You know, actually include the Santarans, not just people who are dressed up as Santarans.
But what was the excuse? I mean, this is a Bob Holm script. This is written by the creator of the Santarans. What happened here?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Bob Holm is obviously, you know, he was a genius writer and wrote some of the greatest of all Doctor Who stories, and certainly script edited all the rest of the greatest Doctor Who stories. I think, like Moffat or, you know, contemporary writers, maybe you've only got a certain amount of Doctor Who in you. Mm-hmm. Before you've got nothing else to say.
Right.
And I mean, I think maybe at this point, you know, he didn't really have a lot else to do to say with these characters. Mm-hmm.
Well, he was.
And he wasn't well.
Let's see, a couple years away from passing, because let's see, we have a story and a half in trial, basically, of Bob Holmes's output. And I think Eric Sayward really liked Bob Holmes. And I think Bob Holmes didn't mind writing for Sayward because the checks that he had under Terrence Dix or Philip Hinchcliffe were gone. So he could,
yeah,
he could get away with whatever he wanted, basically. But
yeah,
for me, it's not an enjoyable story.
No, it's not an enjoyable watch at all.
But the Santarans are probably, to me, they're more of an afterthought, which is really sad because Santarans started out so well when Bob Holmes first wrote them, or wrote A Santarin in The Time Warrior.
Yeah, yeah, they did start out well, and I mean, you know, I mean, they would have been more effective. I don't know, you could have put the Cybermen in there, or
Did you need anything else other than the Androgums?
No, you didn't need anything else other than the Androgums. The Santarins are purely in there as fan service, but what's frustrating is it's not good fan service because they don't act or even look like the Santarins. Mm-hmm. They just look like something that, you know, has the badly assembled accoutrements of a Santarin, mm-hmm. But they aren't actually a Santarin at all. They're just someone dressed up in a Santarin costume.
Right. So, you know, go ahead.
No. I was just gonna go on about it for some more, but I've said enough now.
Yeah. So in Doctor Who magazine, did Doctor Who magazine exploit or have series of the Santarins? You know, Daleks and Cybermen featured heavily. How about the Santarins?
I'm glad you asked me that, because yes, it did. There was a very effective in the early days of when it was Doctor Who Weekly. There was a very effective backup strip with the Santarins, written, I think, by Alan Moore, actually, and illustrated by David Lloyd, or maybe Steve Dillon. I think it was David Lloyd, which was very, very good. There's been a Santarin origin story.
Was that the Final Quest, by chance?
I think that might... I'd have to go over and pull some of my Doctor Who collected comics off my shelves to check on that.
Because I think the Final Quest was written by Steve Moore, right?
Yeah, let me hang on. I'm actually going to do that right now.
Yeah, good.
There we go. It's live radio, kids. He's actually doing something.
We'll put the standby music on.
A Pure Blood is the one I was thinking of, which is written by Dan Abnett, who's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a kind of Santarin origin story where the Santarins, you know, find their origin, the original Santarins pre the clone, mm-hmm. their cloning stuff, come back to kind of threaten the contemporary Santarins.
In the DWM script for Pure Blood, did the Santarins look like present day Santarins? Is that their clone army species, or do they all look like that?
They look. The art is not the best. It's by the artist is Colin Andrew, who isn't one of the greatest Doctor Who magazine illustrators, in my opinion. It's pretty good. The Santarins look too. They look pretty potato-y. But they do look pretty different from each other, so which I guess is helpful to work out who's who. There's been a couple of other, there's been a few more Santarin-centric comic book stories, which I don't actually have on me right now, that's in a box somewhere,
mm-hmm.
which have been kind of less successful. I mean, sometimes I think the magazine kind of default, that the Santarins are kind of, they're treated as sort of Doctor Who's Klingons. They're sort of like noble, potato-faced warrior race.
Right.
When actually I think they're more interesting than that. Mm-hmm. I think they're kind of, you know, their incompetence when it comes to battle, and their, which is basically their incompetence comes from their sadism, I think is actually more interesting than their kind of nobleness and warriorness, mm-hmm. to my mind.
And I think that's a really good description of the Santarins. They are incompetent. Anyone who is carrying on a war for millennia...
Exactly. You can't win a war for literally thousands
right.
of years.
I mean, it
can't be very good at war.
I mean,
yes.
It's like the U.S. and Afghanistan.
Yes,
it's perpetual. At some point, just being at war for the sake of being at war is what your society is about.
Yes. So I think, as I said, to treat them as kind of noble warriors is...
They're not noble at all, really.
They're not noble at all. They're kind of, they're incompetent sadists, which is, as you point out, is why they're still at war after several thousands of mm-hmm. years. And actually, in some ways, that actually informs a little bit some of the characterization of the contemporary Santarins in New Who, which I guess we'll get to next week.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about that then.
I think some of that is maybe slightly overplayed, but I think that's maybe where RTD and Moffat kind of get their Santarins from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the one thing, maybe a closing thought on Santarins, is you are RTD sitting here, like, what was it, 2008?
Yeah.
Are Santarins worth bringing back? Do you have fond enough memories to think, hey, what we really need to do is bring the Santarins back?
Yeah, I was very pleased to have them back. I mean, we'll talk about this next week. I thought they were too blue looking. I prefer their more kind of silvery appearance.
Right.
But I thought they came back very effectively.
Okay.
And you know, and having what's his name from the young ones be the head Santarin was kind of a, you know, stroke of genius actually.
So we will touch on that next time.
We'll touch on that next year. Next week. So we've managed to do a whole hour, even our.
Our idle, tired brains
flopped out of our clone vats, and with a sigh. Yeah, well done us.
Yeah, and
yeah, Santar Ha indeed.
So, thank you for listening to episode 67 of the Metabulous 2 podcast. I have been talking with Ben,
and I have been talking with David.
And thank you. Good night.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Metabulous 2 podcast. You can reach us with email at metabulous2, that's a number 2, at gmail.com, or on Twitter at metabulous2, and again, that's a number 2. Hope to hear from you. Bye.